The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Politics Weekly. I'm Anne Perkins. For Winston Churchill, the best argument against democracy was a five-minute conversation with the average voter. Democracy, moreover, is the worst form of government, Churchill said, except for all of the others that have been tried. But democracy, except in jest, is never seriously questioned in the Western world. Does that mean, therefore, that we take it for granted? And do the pressures of globalisation, financialisation and new technology mean that its health in the Western world should be re-examined? Joining me in the studio is the author and journalist Philip Coggan, otherwise known as Buttonwood, the finance columnist of The Economist magazine. And he's written a fascinating new book called The Last Vote, The Threats to Western Democracy. So first of all, Philip, explain what you mean by that title.
Well, I think the reason is to draw attention to the complacency people can feel about democracy. It's been around in its full form only for 100 years, with all men and women being allowed to vote. And for over 1,000 years before that, many people thought it was a ridiculous way of running a government. And now that we've had it, we seem to think it will last forever. But in fact, even within the 100 years that democracy has existed, there have been two periods when it's wobbled, in the 1930s in Europe and the 1970s in Latin America. And if we get too complacent about it, then it can wobble again. And it is wobbling at the moment. And I'm really trying to say that you cannot get the excitement that you see in some countries like Egypt or whatever, where people get their first vote. But you can treat your vote as if it might fearfully be your last vote, and that not to treat it trivially, not to ignore the chance to vote, but to make sure you participate, because the people who get in now, you may be stuck with for a very long time if things go wrong.
Just give me the defining characteristics of a democracy.
Well, it's changed over the years. So the Athenians had a meeting of people who would decide on things, all men, of course, no slaves, who would take instant decisions. And then in the 18th century, when democracy started to be revived, obviously in America first in a mass form, then we moved to representative democracy. So you vote for someone who makes decisions. But now our modern democracy is morphing again, so that we vote for people who then delegate decisions to experts, technocrats. So double delegation, I call it in the book. So our democratic participation these days is limited for many people just to that one time every 5 years, marking a cross in a box. And that's a shame, I think. So it's a very far removed from the way the Athenians thought about it. And it's led, I think, to this cynicism about the way the political system operates.
I don't see the direct correlation between voting only once every 4 or 5 years and the delegation of powers by politicians. Explain that more fully.
Of course. Well, let's say we've just had Mark Carney give his first big announcement. Mark Carney has been hired at some cost and with much fanfare from the Bank of Canada. He got the terms he wanted. He got extra housing allowance and everything. So he's almost like Manchester United signing Lionel Messi. He can change economic policy, which he just has. Now, who do you or I vote for if we don't like what Mark Carney does? It's hard to think of anybody. There's no way of getting rid of him. The government can, of course, fire him, but it would be an awful U-turn, a humiliating U-turn to fire someone they've hired at such great expense and cost. And if you think in Europe, who's the most important person now? Mario Draghi, the head of the ECB, the debate in America about replacing Ben Bernanke. These people are very powerful. There's no democratic accountability for them.
But just to drill down into that a little bit, it's actually very recent, at least for you and me, that the Bank of England's been independent of government. And select committees of the House of Commons, which I fear you don't kind of consider very much detail, are playing an increasing role in at least in introducing some sense of accountability, even if it's not a kind of veto. And they are strengthening democracy in that way, I would argue.
Yes, I think you're right. That is an encouraging sign. But of course, I am trying to cover the entire of the Western world and not just Britain. But if you think about the way things are going, so monetary policy is now independent with these central bankers. And in some cases, of course, Papademos in Greece, the central bankers have become prime ministers without being elected. Fiscal policy in Europe, setting the taxes, setting the spending, is essentially being kicked up to Brussels. So under this two-pack deal, countries will need to get approval of their budgets in Brussels before they can be pushed through when they're in a debt problem. And of course, if you get in the hands of international creditors like the IMF or whatever, as Britain did in 1976, the same thing applies. Legal decisions are now off in Europe, decided at the European level rather than the British level ultimately. We have all these quangos, which MPs do try to monitor, but, you know, NICE or someone like that has enormous powers to decide life or death issues of them. So because MPs don't feel expert enough to deal with these issues, they are being passed on to technocrats. And we haven't really worked out a fully comprehensive system of monitoring those technocrats. And indeed, in some cases, going back to the central bank example, governments might not want to, because the ability of a central bank to buy your debt, so allow you to hand out benefits to voters without actually having to raise the money from the markets, that's a very powerful tool for governments. And so they're quite happy for it to keep going. But as voters, we need to think about what this means for the long term.
I'm not sure that voters say, well, what really puts me off politics is the fact that we've got an independent Bank of England now, so I don't really have any kind of control over, you know, monetary policy. That's not what pisses voters off about politics.
But effectively, what has happened over the last 5 years is we've chucked out the governments that were in power at the start of the fiscal crisis, pretty much across Europe, apart from Angela Merkel, and we've replaced them with the opposition. And what's happened is that the opposition has followed pretty much the same policies as the previous government. So we have seen that economic policy is now very much constrained, with the central banks as a kind of outside, the cavalry coming to the rescue, if you like, to try and help things out. But on fiscal side, they can't do much. And so people then look from animals at the end of Animal Farm, from sort of pigs to men, and decide that there isn't any difference. And so that's where we're seeing this sort of the double delegation adds to this general disillusion, this feeling that they're all the same. And that's why you're seeing the rise of fringe and extremist parties across Europe. So obviously we've seen in France, you have Marine Le Pen, you have in Italy the sudden rise of Beppe Grillo, you've had Finland, Sweden even, extremist parties, Netherlands, and in Britain we have UKIP. So, and that's part of a long-term trend, which is seeing that the vote of the mainstream parties has tended to decline, perhaps because the class allegiances has gone and the fringe parties have tended to come up.
How about this argument? You're presenting a snapshot of democracy under really very acute strain. As you say several times, clearly, if politicians can't offer voters the hope, I remember that was always what the great John Cole used to say, that's what politics is about, it's selling hope. And if politicians can't do that, then you inevitably put democracy under strain. I think that one of the big differences between the strain and democracy now, and I'm looking at it very much from an Anglo-Saxon perspective, and say in the 1930s, is that then there were very powerful organs of civil society that supported the idea of democracy and also supported voters in an extra political manner. And I don't think that it exists to nearly the same extent now. And that seems to me to be, that kind of atomization of society seems to be a much greater threat to democracy than the other circumstances that you describe.
Well, I'm sure you're right. Robert Putnam, in his book Bowling Alone, talked about the atomization of society in a sense. Well, there are a number of factors at play, which I think is why it's so disturbing. So the attitude towards politicians would have been much more respectful 50, 60 years ago. The way they're treated in the media is much less respectful. We have the internet, which spreads conspiracy theories much more quickly. We have cable TV and so on. So the idea, you know, particularly you get in America, that the guy on the other side is foreign or, you know, a traitor or something, and therefore you shouldn't obey him. That's very harmful to democracy, and you see it a bit in Europe as well. And I think there are other factors at work. So also the way that parties are funded, with the decline in mass membership, means parties are dependent on special interests to fund them. You see this particularly in US, where $6 billion was spent on the US election. So and you've seen this big rise in inequality in the US as well. So you have this danger, which is that the parties depend on the rich people. The rich people depend on policies that suit them. That increases the inequality, which increases the ability of rich people to fund the politicians, and we get down in a downward spiral. And again, that adds to the disillusion of the ordinary people. And the other thing I think is that people do get bored with the system. You can go for a long period where systems seem to be indestructible. Absolute monarchies, after all, lasted for a very long time. And in 1913, you might have thought that the Romanovs or the Habsburgs were going to last for a long time. But then when things go wrong, you rebel against the authorities in power. And if those authorities are democracies, then you're just as likely to rebel against those as you were against monarchies.
I think all of that is kind of rather depressingly persuasive. But one of the things you say when you're talking about the kind of basic nature of democracy is that is obviously everyone has a vote and every vote is equal. And that's the sense is that that's no longer the case. And one of the things that we've lost, and you could argue it merely reinforced a mirage, but one of the things we've lost is all the other ways that would enhance particularly poorer people's votes. And I'm thinking particularly of trade union power. And I think that loss of working class organisations has left ordinary individual low-income earners or unemployed people. Actually, trade unions are never much good with unemployed people, but, you know, that's left a whole big group of people completely outside the kind of real democratic process.
I'm sure you're right. And if you go back into history, how did democracy develop? Well, first of all, the middle classes came along, Great Reform Act, and said, we are paying taxes, we are running businesses, we demand representation. And then as industrialization came on and factory workers grouped together and realized their power, they demanded the right to vote and they got it. So democracy, in a sense, stemmed from people exercising the power and the right to respect and to be judged, and later on women, of course. And now, of course, when with people not having the power, not funding political parties when they have little money, in America particularly, there's a very interesting study which compares how senators vote with what their constituents think, and they pay very close attention to what the richest part of their constituency thinks and no attention at all to what the poor people think. The poor are less inclined to vote, less inclined to be on the register, so their power dwindles and dwindles and dwindles, so that they can go through the form of voting, and then of course there are gerrymandered constituencies where, so if it doesn't really matter, you'll get a Conservative wherever you are or Labour wherever you are. But it doesn't, their influence is really very low. And again, if you feel like that over time, you start to feel that there are only other ways of protesting. So that might be, you know, demonstrations, riots or whatever. And we saw that a couple of years ago. You can argue about what the causes are. But we've seen it across Europe that people have come out in mass demonstrations arguing that the system does not now represent their interests.
I'm interested that your solutions that you propose to this tend to the technological and not so much to trying to reconfigure social institutions. Is that because you think you've got to work with the world we've got and you can't kind of reintroduce some kind of collective effort? Because it seems to me that, you know, allowing people to vote from their, you know, on their handheld devices or whatever, you're just going to kind of exaggerate and magnify the atomization that we already see everywhere. And I'm not sure a democracy can actually function effectively when people aren't organised.
No, it's a fair point. I think anything that helps people to vote more easily. I've got a number of potential solutions, and I wish I could say I had a 36-point plan which would solve everything, and I don't think it is. If we don't solve the economic issue, and we haven't quite mentioned that, which I think the problem is, given our ageing population, it's going to be very hard to grow the economy rapidly. And basically in the last 70 years when democracy's worked fairly well, it's been because we've been able to promise people a slice of a bigger pie. Now we have a sort of static pie, and any bit that we give one group, we're taking away from another, which adds to the potential for conflict. So I think the answer to that is that we need to reform the system and eliminate some of the middle class welfare that we've created to concentrate it on the poor. So, for example, higher rate tax relief on pensions, which is quite a costly benefit, that kind of thing needs to go. That will help in dealing with the issue of protecting the poor. I also suggest that the House of Lords or a second tier should be the place where it keeps an eye on all these quangos, where you do have experts who can monitor it. And if they feel that the quangos are exceeding their powers or taking a step that is wrong or bad for the general population, they can put issues to a referendum. So that would be another way of involving people. They would be kind of like the Court of Appeal for democracy.
But it doesn't deal with my organisational question. I mean,
it's difficult. If you look at what's happening to the economy, people are being atomised in their work. So we don't have the Fords, the British Leylands, where unions can organise. We have, in the last 4 years, 40% of the jobs that have been created have been self-employed. It's very hard to organise the self-employed. And there, arguably, the internet is about the only way you're going to do it. So my last point is to really that it's down to ourselves. Politicians get a bad rap, but they can't solve these problems if we set unrealistic conditions for them. We need to get organised ourselves. It's our fault that things have gone wrong, and we need to get more involved, be less cynical, and engage with the system more. And if we do that, then the influence of the rich, the special interests, will diminish and the influence of the ordinary voter will go up.
Well, I think that's only part of the answer, surely, because how do you get involved when, you know, the political class seems to be kind of a self-perpetuating group of people from, you know, the same schools, the same lobbying firms, you know, there's this closed little bubble here and in Washington and in France, but much less so in someone like Germany, I would guess, because they've got much more powerful regional governments. And I think we've got to have change at the top in order, at the same time as encouraging change at the bottom. I don't see otherwise how you build a case beyond a straightforward ethical one that says you need these wealth transfers. We only get major wealth transfers, as you point out in your book, in the event of some great national catastrophe. And, you know, it took the Second World War to legitimise the kind of wealth transfer that produced the welfare state.
Yes, it's a self-perpetuating element of inequality, as I suggested earlier. But I think we are going through a severe economic crisis. The response to which, the understandable response of central banks, has been to pump up the financial system, but at the same time, and let inflation be higher than target, the effect of which is to make the rich a bit richer and the people on wages a bit poorer. So we haven't really solved that problem at all. And I fear that we may need a big crisis, as you were suggesting, for things to change again, for people to say, well, we cannot go on like this and that we need a better system. Now, one answer to this, again, is to reconfigure government spending. So one poor response of this government to the crisis has been in its spending on infrastructure. So if we can divert money that was on middle-class benefits towards infrastructure that will employ more people, get more people with a higher standard of living, and deal with some of that inequality at the sort of bottom-up level. But it's not an instant solution. I'm afraid it's going to take quite some time.
Do you be very unfair to say that you're a financial journalist and, like somebody with a hammer looking for a nail, a financial journalist looks for a sort of kind of financial solution to a problem that I see as, at least in part, as a political and social or a symptom of a political and social problem?
I think we're just viewing the same problem from a different perspective. But yes, of course, I come from working for The Economist from an economic perspective. But, you know, a fundamental problem for the Western world going forward is an economic one, that we have an aging population and slow-growing economies, and we need to reconfigure our political system to deal with that. Now, you can view that as a kind of organizational one, or you can view it as a reconfiguring the economy to deal with that solution. But we probably end up roughly the same position in the middle when you've finished.
Just you've got to find a story to tell, and I don't think you're going to do it with the numbers, or at least that's only ever going to be part of the story. And I think the really big challenge for the political parties as they exist at the moment is to find a way that engages and mobilises voters. And I'm not sure that giving them different ways of voting
isn't my only solution, as I hope you saw. But I think people just need to wake up. I mean, you look at Italy and you saw that Beppe Grillo, who isn't, you know, a malign figure particularly, got 25% of the vote suddenly. UKIP is coming second in constituencies. There's a big vote out there, 20 to 30% of the electorate that's going. Now, we can argue about how extreme UKIP is, and the surveys unfortunately show that the attitude of UKIP voters and the attitude of BNP voters voters is not that far out of line. It's just that it's more respectable to vote for UKIP. But anyway, there's a big vote floating out there that can go in a malign way. And we need to be very aware of that. I mean, I've tried through the book only to mention Hitler very occasionally, but you have to remember that he was on sort of 2 or 3% of the vote in 1928 and 17% in 1930 and 30% in 1932. So these things can come from nowhere. And we've seen it, you know, all over Europe that Marine Le Pen is, you know, possibly in reach of taking over as the main party of the right in France because the UMP is imploding. So these dangers are more real than we think. And because we've consigned all that to the dim and distant past, I think we just need to wake up as individuals and think that democracy isn't safe unless we ourselves make it so.
I had a very interesting debate, and it's the obvious contrast. You look at China, you look at India, and you look at, you know, if you want to see how a dictatorship works as against a democracy. Do we see in China that actually not having democracy does allow tough decisions to be made, growth to happen more quickly, and just self-interest of the ruling elite means that the bottom of the heap is looked after at least adequately?
Yeah, I think there's a danger that that model will look appealing, and it does look appealing. Or you can look at Russia for another example, where you vote in a strong man, you vote still, but everybody knows who's going to win, right? So that's a danger that the system can create, that people think, well, those old politicians are all corrupt and this man is different and comes from the outside. And in the US, of course, in the past, they voted former generals into office. You know, it's easy for these people to look appealing. And the Chinese have managed things very well, and they would say that they've managed things very well because they don't have democracy. And, of course, that model is quite appealing to much of the rest of the world. And the other danger, which we haven't touched on as well, is this: the treatment of outsiders when you get into economic difficulties. So you had that in the 1930s with Jews, of course, and foreigners within the country. Now we have, you know, a whole series of laws passed in the last 10 years, which democracies have done in wartime in the past, you know, interning Japanese in the US or interning foreigners in Britain in the Second World War. But we've had, you know, internment without trial, Guantanamo Bay. We've had snooping on individual voters. We've had torture by the Americans. And so democracies are rather easy to give up those hard-won rights when they feel they're under threat. And you get the possible danger of the minority of Muslims within the population being treated as these aliens, and this sort of, and again, a negative feedback process where the alienation of those people leads to protests. Those protests make the majority population more nervous, which leads to a bigger crackdown and so on. So, again, that's another factor that we have to worry about. Liberal democracy is not just a matter of voting every 5 years. It's a matter of free speech. It's a matter of a right to fair trial. And we've sort of tinkered with giving up on those rights over the last 10 years. And that's more things that we need to safeguard.
And I would argue that they are probably the most important things. They are the real buttresses of democracy, along with a transparent and as far as conceivably possible, uncorrupted political system.
Yeah, if you go back to the 19th century, most people would say Britain was a fairly free country, even though everybody didn't have the vote. And it was seen as, you know, much more liberal than anywhere on Europe, because those rights had been established, you know, over a very long period, going all the way back to Magna Carta, slowly but surely. And we tinker with them again at our peril, because once you've said that you can't express certain opinions, it's easy to extend that. Once you start snooping on potential terrorists, you start arresting people for taking pictures of policemen and so on. And the state takes any small power that it's given and tends to expand it as much as possible. And we need to be aware of that too.
Phil Coggan, thank you very much indeed. And Philip's book, The Last Vote, The Threats to Western Democracy, is out on the 5th of September, published by Alan Lane. The producer of Politics Weekly is Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Thanks for listening.